Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota chapter of the Wildlife Society is celebrating 50 years in the state. Shane Mahoney is keynote speaker for their annual meeting. He's the president and CEO of Conservation Visions Incorporated. He has been listed as one of the 10 most influential conservationists in Canada by Outdoor Canada magazine and one of the 25 most important conservationists in North America, as well as being nominated for Person of the Year by Outdoor Life magazine. He joins us today from Newfoundland, Canada. Shane Mahoney, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Now, you say there's a widespread and intense debate about the role and use of wildlife in our society. Elaborate on that a little bit to get us started.
Well, this is not a surprising debate. To some extent, it has existed for a long period of time. But currently, there is an intensification of this discussion about whether we should use animals and under what circumstances we should use animals. And this has spilled over not only into the world of hunting, of course, and angling, but has also spilled over to some extent into the world of agriculture and the use of domesticated species. The issue is of great significance, of course, because despite the modern world in which we live, billions of people still require sustenance that derives directly from the use of animals in one way or another. And as we think about it in a broad context, we realize that, you know, all world fisheries obviously include the use of sentient creatures at one level or another, as does the world of hunting and angling recreationally, as does the world of domestic livestock production. And there is a very deep-rooted, of course, tension in us as human beings with respect to the use of animals, because we have always been fascinated with them. We have always depended upon them. We have, in many ways, always loved them and idolized them. They were the caricatures of gods in some cultures. They have been the currency of in others. And from our very beginnings as hunter-gatherers, which essentially encompass 99.9% of our existence on this planet, they were the absolute essential elements of our survival. And in a very real way, they made us human by teaching us and illustrating for us the differences between them and ourselves.
So where do we begin in sort of trying to achieve that mutual respect for humans who have different ideas about the use of animals in the 21st century?
Well, I think, first of all, the polarization that occurs on both sides, if we can limit it simplistically to a two-sided debate, the polarization that occurs on both sides is something that we have to strive very hard to dismiss. On the one hand, people who are in cultures or circumstances or traditions where the use of animals is routine will argue that this is just something that should be accepted across the board. On the other hand, there are groups of people who are opposed to all use of animals, who simply write out a prescription for the rest of the world and say we must develop a means of sustaining ourselves that does not involve the use of animals at all. I think what we have to try and do is to appeal to a more moderate, centrist position, which recognizes the undeniable dependence that we still have on wild and domesticated living organisms for our own sustenance and survival, while at the same time introducing values that look for the proper treatment of all animals, values that are concerned with animal welfare in all circumstances, and standards that respect these wild others that share the planet with us. I don't think it is at all impossible to develop sensitive relationships with wild creatures and also to be involved in the harvesting of them. Most traditional cultures, Native American cultures, for example, in our own circumstances on this continent, have reflected deep respect and attachment to wild creatures, while at the same time recognizing the necessity of actually using them. Joseph Campbell, the greatest American mythologist perhaps ever, you know, when asked to sum up what was the great truth of existence, said simply that flesh eats flesh. And it is really an undeniable ecological principle Some people wish to get beyond this by, you know, adopting a vegan lifestyle or vegetarian lifestyle, but there are costs and benefits associated with all manners in which we engage with the natural world, and none of them are without cost and risk to some extent.
You have written about the democracy of hunting, so I want to turn this a little bit to the economic side of things, because when I think of South Dakota and hunting, I also think of tourism as an industry for us. Tell us what the democracy of hunting means and how it applies to us here.
Well, the reason I call it the democracy, or have written about the democracy of hunting, is that the participation in what we term recreational hunting, if you will, and recreational angling, similarly, which, by the way, involves about 45 million people in Canada and the United States each year, this recreational engagement is something that has deep roots in American culture and American history. And the attempt was made to democratize it in both Canada and the United States by not making it simply a subject for the elites, but something that every citizen could participate in. Every citizen had a right to participate in, as long as they, you know, did it legally and in a fair circumstance. The end result of that is a model for conservation in North America that has led to the recovery and a resurgence of wildlife, and also to, in addition to that amazing abundance of wild creatures, we have incredible economies that have benefited local communities, regional centers, as well as states and the continent at large. If you look at the expenditures in a place like South Dakota, for example, you look at something that in the neighborhood of $190 to $200 million in retail sales associated with hunting in your state alone. And those expenditures, you know, create jobs, and they benefit many people in many communities. In addition to that, the harvest of wild food that occurs by this democratic engagement, in other words, by every citizen who does it legally, is of extreme importance still for many, many people and many families and many communities. And it's something that in our modern times we sometimes forget about. But the harvest of wild fish and wild creatures otherwise by 45 million Canadians and Americans is really an astounding sustainable wild harvest, and maybe one of the most environmentally friendly food production systems in the world. This could only exist in a circumstance where the decision was made legislatively and socially to allow all citizens of all ranks, if you will, in society to participate. And that democratic engagement with hunting and angling is really not something that you see everywhere in the world. It's very much a North American phenomenon, and in fact had its great birthing in the United States of America, which led many experiments in democracy, obviously.
What's an individual hunter's responsibility for wildlife conservation? How do you approach that when you just grow up hunting with your mom or dad?
Well, first of all, my personal opinion is that in this broad field of conservation, which I think ought to be a responsibility of citizenship for every person in the world, regardless of the nation in which they live, you know, I think this responsibility is critical, and I think hunters have to be the ones that bear an even greater sense of responsibility in this regard. It is my opinion that those of us who have harvested wild creatures, who have taken the lives of wild creatures, have a much greater responsibility for conservation efforts than anyone else in society. This is a personal view of mine. And I think the role that hunters need to play is to be out front as the leading spokespeople for respectful use of wild creatures, for fighting for their preservation, for fighting for policies and laws that protect the habitat that wild creatures depend upon, and also for recognizing that the wildlife resources that we have today are not ours. They are held in a public trust for all citizens, and not just the citizens of today, not just my generation or yours or someone else's, but for all generations to come. And I think any hunter who really fulfills the ideal that was personified by people like Theodore Roosevelt and George Bird Grinnell and other Aldo Leopold and other great leaders of this. Any hunter should be standing up for those kinds of principles in the most aggressive way possible. Hunters, I think, have a responsibility to be recognized as the greatest conservationist of all people because they have this greater sense and duty, really, to conservation as a result of the fact that they have harvested wild creatures. While many, many citizens participate in the viewing and enjoyment, photography, etc., of wild creatures, they have not necessarily ever taken the life of one. And I think as soon as a person does, the equation of responsibility changes.
So let's talk about the urban listener. Obviously, we have cities in our state with people who have never gotten their food from anywhere other than the meat counter at the grocery store, or if they're vegetarian, just from the grocery store, the farmer's market. What's their responsibility for wildlife conservation?
Well, as I said, I don't think that it's conservation is the responsibility of one sector in society. I believe the great moral and ethical lesson of Theodore Roosevelt was that every citizen has this responsibility. I believe that for people who chose to be vegetarian, that is a wonderful thing, and it takes a great deal of care and thought to do that successfully. But I think they, too, obviously care about wildlife. They, too, care about the natural world. They, too, care about where their food comes from. And I don't see a divide between urban and rural people in the sense that only one should or could participate in the conservation movement. I think that people who live in urban centers have equal opportunity, if not more, to speak about conservation issues, to influence legislative action, to be part of the political process that determines the future of wildlife. But I also think that they can lobby for much greener urban environments. I don't see any reason in the world why we can't have greater amounts of green space in most of our cities. I don't see any reason in the world why there aren't more opportunities for young people in urban environments to at least see, you know, living plants and bees and butterflies that come to pollinate them, and people who have small gardens. I mean, people can even have small gardens on patios, for goodness sake, in major cities. So I think that the engagement with nature may be quite different for many people in urban centers than in rural, but I don't think the responsibility towards wildlife and the natural world is any different. And my own personal view is that we need every possible kind of engagement for conservation and every possible viewpoint. Just because a person is a hunter doesn't make them a conservationist. Just because somebody is a non-hunter doesn't make them one either. One becomes a conservationist by making willful choices to do things in support of the wild others that share this planet with us. My own personal view, therefore, is a very inclusive one, and I think that we should have far more engagement by urban people in broad debates, and I think we need to have a much greater understanding between rural and urban people about the things we agree on. And we all agree that we want wildlife with us. We all agree that we want clean water, that we want clean air, that we want healthy food. There is so much that we agree upon that sometimes I see the urban-rural dichotomy or split in the dialogue over conservation to be, you know, kind of very unnatural, if I could use that term.
Give me one first step that I could make today to be part of this conversation in a positive way and to make changes that are going to sort of help in the efforts.
Well, I think every single human being has a voice. Some people have voices that are best expressed in an interview such as this. Some people have a voice that's best expressed by talking to their friends over their fence. Some people have a voice that's best expressed by writing a letter to their local newspaper. Some people have a voice that's best expressed by arranging a small discussion group at a coffee house, you know, once a month or once a week. The idea that conservation should be left to governments, or that conservation should be left to, you know, organized entities, no matter how good they are, whether it's the World Wildlife Fund or Pheasants Forever or the Dallas Safari Club or the Wild Sheep Foundation or whatever any of those groups are, is just, it's not workable. It will work because people at the individual level do the right things for the conservation of nature. Not the same things, because people will have different values and different perspectives, but do the right things for the conservation of the natural world. I think one of the beautiful things about conservation, it's not like space research, where not everybody can participate. The beautiful thing about conservation is that every single person, in addition to having a responsibility, can actually do something for the natural world and for wild creatures. Every single person can do something in this regard. And this is sometimes perhaps a truth that is lost upon people because they think they have to have some sort of special training or background or be member of a specific group to do something for the natural world. It's just not true. Everyone can do something.
Shane Mahoney, it has been a delight. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having this discussion.
Enjoy your time in South Dakota, sir.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Shane Mahoney, President and CEO of Conservation Visions Incorporated. He visits South Dakota in honor of the South Dakota chapter of the Wildlife Society's 50 years in the state. When we come back after the break, Jim Kent takes you to White Clay and Paige Sarda takes you to the center of the earth. You're listening to Dakota Midday, SDPB Radio.